When she speaks again, she tries to make her voice sound more matter-of-fact. I had to come home. I'm trying to get well. I've got PTSD. I take medication for it, she says. These horrible images keep coming back to me, and I never know when they're going to come. I hear a sound. It's like something trips in my head, and I'm back there, in the chaos, waiting for the killing to start. She raises her eyes then and looks at each one of them, their pale faces looming above their dark blankets, as if their heads are disembodied and floating in the air. Gwen whispers, her face close to hers.
Oh, Riley, I'm sorry. I didn't realize. I had no idea what happened to you.
Riley's hands are trembling, and she clasps them together. Last night, when I was falling asleep, I thought I heard a scream, but I ignored it because I didn't think it was real. I hear screams in my head every night when I try to go to sleep. She lowers her voice again to a whisper, and I hear them every night when I dream. When she stops speaking, the silence is complete, except for the crackling of the fire. Even the wind has died down for the moment. Then Lauren says, I'm so sorry. Henry says nothing. Matthew plays nervously with his gun. Beverly shrinks into her blanket, chilled to the bone. She's sickened by what Riley has said. She watches Gwen rubbing Riley's back. Riley's obvious terror is contagious. Beverly's frightened of what's out there, lurking in the shadows. She doesn't think the killer is one of these people sitting around the fire. She thinks he's out there, waiting. She feels like a cornered mouse, eyes bright, chest heaving rapidly with each breath. Henry is sitting near the fireplace in the dark. She thinks about their children, Teddy and Kate. How will they cope if their mother and father don't come home? She just wants to go home with Henry, she tells herself. She wants things to be the way they used to be. David drinks his coffee down to the dregs, even though it's cold now. He must stay awake. He got very little sleep last night, and now his eyes burn and feel gritty. He surveys his little flock of sheep, for that's how he thinks of them. They seem like sheep because they're all frightened and they don't know what to do. Matthew is making him uneasy. He seems a bit agitated. David would like to get the gun away from him, but doesn't want a confrontation. He can't predict what Matthew might do. He can't predict what any of them might do. The revelations about Riley make sense. Her history, her experience. They explain her volatile personality, her startled eyes, constantly scanning, her tension, her drinking. He knew she was a journalist. But if she's been in Afghanistan for the last 3 or 4 years, maybe she doesn't know about him at all. Maybe she was just jealous that he was interested in Gwen rather than her. Maybe Gwen has no idea about his past. But Gwen told him there was something she wanted to talk to him about. No doubt it's his murdered wife. Or, it just occurs to him now, maybe it's something about her. Maybe she's involved with someone and neglected to tell him last night. He will have no possibility of any kind of future with Gwen if they don't make it through the night. He needs to think about the problem right in front of him. To hell with Riley and what she might think she knows. David tries to look at the situation analytically, the way he would look at a case. The most likely scenario is that Dana's fiancé, Matthew, killed her. They'd argued. Perhaps he'd pushed her down the stairs. Perhaps he hadn't meant to. But once he'd done it, he realized he had to finish her off. Maybe. But Candace. Maybe she did have something on Matthew or Dana. Or maybe she knew something about Dana's death. Perhaps she'd seen something. Heard something. Had she been snooping on Dana and Matt? She knew who they were. She might have been listening outside the door, overheard their argument, and then scuttled out of sight when the door opened and seen, or perhaps heard, Matthew push Dana down the stairs. If so, why didn't she say anything? Maybe she was too afraid to say anything until the police arrived and was biding her time. Maybe that's what got her killed. If he had to give an opinion, he's with Henry on this one. He thinks it was probably Matthew. He lied about the argument. He's the most likely one to have murdered Dana. Candace might have known something or have had some connection to them in some way. And Matthew may be trying to throw suspicion on James and Bradley while bolstering the view that there's someone else out there. Or maybe there is someone out there killing them for sport. And if he's killing them for sport because he can, because he wants to, none of them is safe. Chapter 23. Saturday, 10:20 p.m. Gwen tries to relax into the sofa. She feels relatively safe here, surrounded by the others. She watches Matthew out of one eye. He's hypervigilant, his eyes constantly scanning the dark void beyond them, as if alert to any threat. But the effect of his attentiveness is not calming at all, but the opposite. She has more confidence in David. His presence makes her feel safe. She pulls the blanket more tightly around her neck and withdraws into herself. She's relieved that the truth is out about Riley. She hadn't known about the PTSD, about her being held hostage, but it all makes sense. She thinks it will help Riley for people to understand her, to be supportive. Then she will try to be more supportive too. Trauma changes people. She should know. She broods into the dark. If they survive this, of course they will, she tells herself. They're all together now and nothing is going to split them up. Then she has to tell David the truth about herself. But first, she wants to ask him about who he is. She hopes, it's frightening just how much she hopes, that he's not the person Riley believes he is. She hopes he's someone else altogether, that Riley's confusing him with someone else. But Riley is usually right about things. First, they have to get out of here. She closes her eyes briefly and says a little prayer, begging for the police to come. Sunday, 12:05 a.m. It's after midnight when things start to unravel. The lobby is quiet, but no one is sleeping. Riley finds the silence unbearable. She needs conversation to keep the terrifying images at bay. She keeps glancing into the dark at the spot where Dana's body used to be, remembering her awful, lifeless face. Candace, with her scarf wound tightly around her neck. She doesn't want to think about the killings or about what might happen to the rest of them. So she thinks about David Paley instead. She becomes fixated on him until it's like an itch she has to scratch. She can't stop herself. She leans toward David, who is also wide awake, across from her on the other side of the coffee table, and whispers, "I know who you are." For a moment, she thinks he's going to ignore her, pretend he didn't hear. She's about to repeat herself more loudly, but then he leans toward her. She can see his face, resolute in the glow of the oil lamp. "What is it that you think you know?" he says back in a low voice, but he's not whispering. Riley feels Gwen tense beside her. Gwen places a restraining hand on her leg, under the blanket, but she disregards it. "I knew I recognized your name last night, but I couldn't place it. But I kept thinking about it, and then I remembered. This morning." She's not whispering anymore. She's aware of the others, now alert, listening. He stares back at her, waiting for her to say it. So she does. "You're that attorney who was arrested for murdering his wife." The silence around the fireplace suddenly takes on a different quality. It's fraught with the shock of the others, hearing this for the first time. "Arrested and cleared," he says crisply. "So it is you," Riley hisses with satisfaction. It feels good to be right. She turns to look at Gwen, wanting to gloat. But Gwen looks back at her with something almost like hatred in her eyes, which throws her for a minute. I told you, Riley says to her. The charges were dropped, David says more firmly. I didn't do it. He's looking now at Gwen to gauge her reaction. Just because the charges were dropped, Riley says, doesn't mean you didn't do it. It just means they didn't think they could prove it. She smirks and adds dismissively, it's always the husband. Gwen says, shut up. Riley looks at her in surprise. I'm doing you a favor. I told you this guy is bad news. Gwen says he didn't do it. Oh, and you believe him? Riley says sarcastically. Lauren says, looking at David in shock, your wife was murdered? Yes, David admits, but not by me. There's a lengthy, stunned pause as everyone takes this in. Then Ian asks, did they get the person who did it? No. Hang on, Henry says, his voice accusing. Why should we believe you? He's raised his voice. We're sitting around here, waiting for someone else to get killed, and we find out that your wife was murdered? Let's all calm down, Ian says. Why don't we let him tell his story? I can tell you the story, Riley says, without taking her eyes off David. It was in all the papers. Some of you must have heard about it. Respected New York City defense attorney comes home late one night and finds his wife lying in a pool of blood in the kitchen of their upscale home in an expensive suburb. She'd been beaten to death. She leans aggressively toward David. Her head was bashed in and her back was broken, I believe. Have I got it right so far? She asks him. He doesn't answer, but stares woodenly back at her. Riley continues. He claimed he came home and found her dead. The trouble was, he didn't call 911 for almost an hour. They didn't get along, and she was insured for $1 million. He was arrested almost immediately, but he got a very good lawyer. Because, you see, he knows people. She sits back in satisfaction and looks at everyone else in the room, one by one, except for Gwen. She doesn't dare look at her. They've all been listening attentively to her, and now they all turn and stare at David. Hearing Riley tell it in her accusing, sneering way, David knows how terrible it sounds. He's aware of them all staring at him and feels angry that he has to defend himself again. He is always having to defend himself. At this moment, he hates Riley. Hates her, not because she has outed him. He's used to people recognizing him after all, whispering about him. His was a very public disgrace. But because of her ugly motives. She wants to prevent Gwen and him from getting closer. He was going to tell Gwen himself, but now she's heard it the worst possible way. What happened to him will never go away. He will always be defending himself. And there will always be people who don't believe him. He's learned that people will believe what they want to believe, and it's truly frightening how easily they'll believe it. He'd come home late from work, like most nights when he was in the middle of a trial. He can hardly remember the details of that trial now. He didn't finish it in any case. Someone else from the firm took it over. His wife's violent murder had resulted in an investigation. And his arrest. He hadn't worked for months afterward. He remembers coming home that night. The house was mostly dark. There was one light left on over the porch, but inside, the only light was coming from the kitchen, the stove light. They usually left it on all night, as a sort of nightlight for the first floor. He came in the door quietly, like he always did those days. He didn't call out, Barbara, I'm home, like he used to. The way he did back when she was still happy to see him. He took off his coat and hung it in the hall closet. His first thought was that she'd already gone to bed without him. It was perfectly true that they hadn't been doing too well together at the time. He couldn't deny that they'd been having marital problems, just like he couldn't deny that her life was insured. It didn't seem to matter that he was financially well off already. They seemed to think that even the financially secure could never be too greedy. It had been a strike against him. He'd been astonished. He was insured for the same amount, but that hadn't mattered either. They thought $1 million life insurance policy was excessive. He'd sat down in the living room, exhausted. Trials wore him out. He'd sat there for some time, thinking about how things had gone in court that day, how they might go tomorrow, and then about his life, how hard things were with Barbara. He was too depleted even to get up and go into the kitchen to pour himself a drink, which, as things turned out, was very bad for him. But eventually he got up and made his way through the dark living room and dining room to the kitchen. It was only when he was almost there that the little hairs on the back of his neck began to stir. He still doesn't know why. He suspects that he could smell the blood on some level, even though he was not consciously aware of it. Then he made it to the kitchen door and saw her. She was crumpled on the kitchen floor in her nightgown. It looked as if she'd been struck down while making herself a cup of herbal tea. There was a cup on the counter, an opened package of tea beside it. But she was on the floor, soaked in her own blood. She'd been bludgeoned to death, her head smashed in, her face beaten to a pulp. One arm was splayed beneath her, obviously broken. Through his paralyzing horror, one of his first thoughts was to wonder if she'd suffered, whether the first blow had caught her by surprise, and whether it had killed her. But he knew Barbara, and he suspected she fought back tooth and nail. There was blood everywhere. Of course she'd fought back. Barbara had never been meek. Her arm had indeed been broken. And it turns out, they told him later, that her back had been broken as well. She had been kicked viciously after death. That's another thing that made them suspect him. It looked like a crime of passion. But perhaps it was just made to look that way. That's what David thought at the time. Someone had tried to set him up. He finally speaks. "Most of what you say is true. I was working late that night. When I got home, the house was dark. I assumed Barbara, my wife, had already gone to bed." He takes a deep breath, exhales. "We hadn't been getting along. We'd talked about separating. It wasn't a secret. She'd told some of her friends. I'd told a friend or two at work." "It's also true," he says, looking directly at Riley, "that she had a life insurance policy for $1 million, as did I. We'd both had those policies for many years, from early in our marriage." He looks around the group, his eyes resting finally on Gwen. He tries to read her expression, but he can't. It's too dark. She is leaning back against the sofa across from him, in shadow. "I didn't kill her. She was already dead when I got there. I found her lying on the kitchen floor, covered in blood." He hesitates. "I switched on the overhead light. It was the most horrible moment of my life." He pauses for a moment to recover himself. "I thought she'd been stabbed repeatedly. There was so much blood. But there was no knife there. She was so badly beaten." He covers his face with his hands. Slowly, he brings his hands down again and continues speaking. "I called 911 immediately. I said that I'd come home from work and found her. My mistake was that in that 911 call, I didn't mention that I'd been sitting alone in the living room for almost an hour before I found her. I didn't think to mention it. I was very distressed. I wasn't thinking clearly. And then my next-door neighbor told the police that he had noted the time that I drove in the driveway and parked the car. He'd seen the lights and knew the exact time. Then, when they asked me about the discrepancy between the time I got home and the time of the 911 call, I immediately told them the truth, but they were suspicious. They arrested me. After all, he gives Riley a bitter look. I was the husband. People knew our marriage was in trouble. Then somebody made a big deal about the insurance policy. He takes a deep breath and exhales. It was a living hell, an unbelievable nightmare. My wife had been murdered, and I was arrested for it, put in jail, denied bail, and I hadn't done it. There's a long silence while everyone tries to digest what they've just heard. But they dropped the charges, Gwen says, her voice low. He looks back at her. She's leaned forward a bit.
Yes. They didn't have any evidence against me. They assumed I had a motive, but there wasn't one scrap of physical evidence to pin the crime on me. If I'd done it, I would have had blood on me, on my clothes. They tried to figure out how I could have killed her and cleaned myself up and destroyed any evidence in that hour. But they didn't have anything. They didn't even have the murder weapon. The most damning thing was that I didn't have an alibi. I was sitting alone for that hour in my own living room. They determined that the time of death must have been very close to around the time I arrived home. I must have missed whoever did it by a few minutes. The investigating officers asked the neighbor if he'd seen anything, but he'd been out at his bridge game up until just before he saw me arrive, so he was no help. And the neighbor on the other side of us was out of town, and the ones across this street go to bed early. No one saw anything. He looks intently at the small group seated around him, listening with wide eyes. Anyone could have parked on the street and walked up to the front door, or snuck in the back. Nothing was stolen. There was no sign of forced entry. But Barbara might have let someone in if she knew him. She wasn't afraid of anyone. Maybe she was having an affair. I don't know. I never suspected such a thing. They didn't find anything like that. David shakes his head slowly. Someone obviously wanted her dead, or was setting me up, he says. I'd like nothing more than to find out who. He frowns deeply. They had to drop the charges, but this stigma has become part of my life. I wish I could say I've gotten used to it, but I haven't. I don't think I ever will. He looks at each of them in turn. I can't make any of you believe me. I've told the truth, but I found that people believe what they want to believe. I can't help that.
Chapter 24. Gwen has listened to both sides of David's story with a feeling of horror. She is much colder inside her blanket now than she was before. It sounds worse than she expected. She thought at first that maybe they'd arrested him simply because he was the husband and had quickly realized their mistake. But this sounds so inconclusive, unsatisfactory. There hadn't been enough evidence to send him to trial, but does she believe him? Riley is right about one thing. He would have had the best possible defense lawyer. It's very disturbing, the admission of the missing hour between his arriving home and calling 911. And he's a criminal defense attorney. He would know what to do, how to destroy evidence, or get rid of it. She doesn't know what to believe. Henry squirms uncomfortably in his seat. His breathing is shallow. This entire situation is becoming more and more surreal. All these revelations are bizarre. Riley, with her stories of being held hostage, of having a gun held to her head, of severed limbs in the streets. No wonder she's so peculiar. And this thing about David has given him a nasty jolt. My God, did he murder his wife? Henry suspects he is looking at it from a slightly different perspective than the others. He looks at his wife, seated a short distance away, and allows his gaze to rest on her. He doesn't doubt that David killed his wife, because he can understand it. He can understand the impulse to want to kill your wife, to just want to end things and to be able to move on without all the carping. He would like to reach over to the hearth and grab the iron poker, it's an arm's length away, and strike his unsuspecting wife over the head with it. He knows just how it would feel, how the poker would feel in his hand, because he's been tending the fire occasionally. He imagines leaning down as if to poke the flames, then changing course and turning suddenly, raising his arm and bringing the poker down as fast and as hard as he can and spilling her brains. Would she look up in time to realize what he was doing? What would her face look like? He would have to make the first blow count. He wonders if a poker would do it, if it would be heavy enough. Would he have enough force in his arm? How many times would he have to hit her, to be sure? Perhaps something heavier. Henry realizes he's clenching his hands into fists underneath the blanket. He blinks his eyes rapidly, as if to dispel the fantasy, which has run away with him. Of course he wouldn't do that. Even if there was no one here watching, he still wouldn't do it. Thoughts are not actions. They aren't the same thing at all. But he can understand the impulse, so he has no difficulty believing that David might have murdered his wife. He catches his own wife staring back at him in the dark. For a moment, he wonders nervously if she can read his thoughts. But then he has a thought, and before he fully considers it, he voices it out loud. Maybe Candace knew David. Maybe she was writing a book about him. He leans toward David. You say the case was in all the papers. That's ridiculous, David says dismissively. Is it? Maybe she knew something about the case and was going to put it in a book, and you found out she was going to be here, and you came up here to put a stop to it. That's nonsense, Gwen says indignantly. Then how do you explain Dana's death? Why on earth would he kill her? That's ridiculous. No, it isn't. Because here's my theory. Matthew argued with Dana and pushed her down the stairs. David killed Candace because she was writing an exposé about him. The two are unconnected. Pure coincidence. Who do you think you are? Beverly snipes. Hercule Poirot? Henry gives his wife a dirty glance. Lauren says slowly, I did notice Candace staring at David at dinner last night. She was paying attention to Matthew and Dana and David. Nobody else. You had your back to her, David, but she was definitely staring at you.
Maybe it's time for another drink, Ian says into the charged silence that follows.
When Bradley doesn't move from his seat, Ian gets up and pulls the bar cart closer himself. It's hard to see in the dim light. He picks up the oil lamp from the coffee table and holds it aloft over the bar cart.
There's still plenty here, he says.
Ian pours and hands out the drinks, sits down again in his place nestled next to Lauren, and says thoughtfully,
I have a story to tell, too. It's not much, really. No dark secrets. I haven't been accused of murdering anyone. I've never been arrested. I've never been to a war zone and seen people slaughtered. I had a pretty normal childhood growing up in Iowa with two parents and my brothers.
He goes quiet for a moment.
Except when I was 13, my younger brother died. He was 10. That was tough.
Gwen asks, what happened?
He drowned in a local pond.
I'm so sorry, Gwen says. He nods and looks down at the drink in his hand.
My mother was beside herself. He'd gone to the pond by himself. He wasn't allowed to go on his own, but the rest of us were all off doing something else, and he went anyway. He was like that, willful, hard to manage, didn't do what he was told, always did what he wanted, to hell with the consequences. When he didn't turn up for supper, we went looking for him.
It wasn't that unusual. We were always coming home late for supper.
He hesitates a moment, takes a gulp of his drink, then says,
I was the one who found him.
Lauren reaches out and takes his hand, pulls it into her lap. He'd already told her this.
My parents never really got over it. It pretty much shattered them. So, I guess that's a blip in my otherwise normal childhood.
That's tragic, Riley says, with genuine sympathy.
It was a long time ago,
Ian says, and reaches for his drink. David is observing Ian carefully. He's been observing all of them while trying to appear as if he isn't. There was something about the way Ian told the story about his brother that bothers him. David's used to interviewing clients who are pretty damned good at lying. Usually he can tell. The way the eyes drift up and to the left, the hesitations, the fleeting facial expressions. There's just enough light from the oil lamp to see Ian's face. And if he'd been asked to give an opinion on whether Ian was telling the truth about his brother, he would have said no. He knows it's not always possible to tell if someone's lying. He's been proved wrong before, and he's tired, stressed, and the circumstances are highly unusual for all of them. But something about Ian just now, a man he has so far found to be warm, open, and uncomplicated, has put him on notice. Chapter 25. There's a strange, compelling sort of intimacy in this room, with the oil lamp flickering and the fire crackling, all of them sitting around together wrapped in blankets because they're afraid to go to their rooms. It's seductive. But Lauren says quietly, I'm afraid I don't have any dark secrets either. That's not exactly true. She has survived a dysfunctional family and an awful, short-lived stint in a foster home, but she has survived. She has made something of herself. She doesn't have to share that with anyone if she doesn't want to. Of course, there have been some things in my life that have been difficult, which I won't share with you. Family problems, the usual. I don't think anybody comes out of a family unscathed. She smiles wanly. But I certainly haven't got anything to hide. Nothing? Riley prods. Lauren studies Riley, who is looking at her as if she doesn't believe her. Riley seems to have something against her. Fair enough. Lauren was a bit hard on her a little while ago. She pretty much told her she thought there was something seriously wrong with her. At least now they know what it is and why. Still, she's not going to take any shit from Riley. Why is that so hard to believe? Lauren asks her point blank. Riley shrugs, looks away. Lauren decides to let it go. But Henry asks,
Then what's with the sleeping pills?
Lauren is taken aback. I have trouble sleeping. I always have. So I take sleeping pills.
It's true, Ian says, nodding beside her.
Then, surprisingly, Riley turns to Gwen and says, If it's true confession time, why don't you tell everyone your deep, dark secret? Startled, Lauren watches Gwen give Riley a hard look. But Riley has drunk down her glass of wine very quickly and seems to be shedding her inhibitions and possibly her good sense. She's a sloppy drunk, Lauren's noticed. She's suddenly very curious about what's going to happen next. She wonders what Riley has on Gwen. She'd like to know. Piss off, Riley, Gwen says. Her heart is fluttering anxiously. She doesn't want to be put on the spot. Gwen doesn't want to share her past with anyone. She doesn't want to spill it all in front of this group of strangers. Not in front of David. Definitely not like this. But she wonders how it would feel to unburden herself, to confess to someone other than Riley. Perhaps it would be liberating. Perhaps she would be able to forgive herself then. Riley would no longer have this hold over her. Maybe they would no longer be friends. She looks across at David. his handsome face inscrutable. She wants to tell him. She wants to see how he'll react. She looks at him and doesn't even know what kind of man she's looking at. He could be a man who killed his wife, with sufficient presence of mind to successfully cover his tracks. Henry suggested that he might have killed Candace. She doesn't know. She wishes they had never come here to this horrible, godforsaken place. Wishes she had never met David, who has her in turmoil, or any of these other people either.
Are you okay?
David asks her. His concern is so tempting, but she must guard against it. She feels herself go suddenly cold, emotionless. I'm fine.
She knows her voice sounds harsh, as if she's pushing him away. She wants to push all these horrible people away, especially Matthew, playing incessantly with his gun. But, she tells herself, it must be very disorienting to suddenly, violently, lose someone who knows you better than anyone else, someone you've counted on to anchor your world.
Sunday, 1:10 a.m. David slumps back against his seat, exhausted, stinging from Gwen's rebuke. Matthew's fidgeting is putting everyone on edge. David says abruptly, "Matthew, put the gun down. It's making everybody nervous." Matthew's hands go still, but he doesn't put the gun down. Instead, he says, "You can all sit here and wait. I'm going to go after this son of a bitch." He gets up suddenly from his chair. "Where's that flashlight?"
"You can't," David tells him sternly. "You can't go anywhere on your own, even with the gun. It's too dangerous."
"What do I care?"
Matthew looks with contempt at the rest of them. "Are you going to give me the flashlight or not?"
"It's almost dead," David reminds him as Matthew snatches it up. "Don't do this," David says.
This is what he feared, the group splitting up. He thinks they should stick together. He doesn't want Matthew going off on his own. Nobody wants a jumpy, overwrought man running around with a gun in his hand. His little flock is coming apart. There might be someone out there waiting for one of them to break ranks and run into the dark to be his next victim. Or the killer might be right here, within arm's reach. Should he just let Matthew go? Maybe he will be killed out there, and then they will know it isn't one of them. He's tempted to use Matthew as bait, David realizes with a sickening feeling.
"Does anyone want to come with me?"
Matthew asks. David wrestles with himself. Should he go too, leaving the rest? He glances at the others, watching Matthew nervously. No one else answers either.
"Fine, I'll go myself."
"But," Gwen says, "how do you think you'll find him? We've been all over this hotel. Stay here, with us. In the morning, we'll all go together out to the road." She pauses and adds, "Please." He gives her a last dismissive look, turns away toward the staircase, and is slowly swallowed up by the darkness. Beverly watches anxiously as the group remaining falls into a fraught silence. There are 9 of them left sitting around the fireplace. Gwen and David sitting across from one another, Lauren and Ian on one of the sofas, she and Henry sitting in armchairs across from each other, Riley, who has left the sofa where she'd been sitting with Gwen and moved to the hearth, and James and Bradley sitting together close by. Beverly wonders if Matthew has just gone to his death. Suddenly, David gets up, mutters an expletive, and follows Matthew into the inky blackness. Riley says, "What an idiot." Beverly wishes fervently that David would come back. She wants to get out of here alive. She wants to survive the night. She can't bear that he has deserted them. For Matthew, the loss of Dana has been completely destabilizing. He walks quickly up the dark staircase and arrives on the 3rd floor of the old hotel, holding the fading flashlight, which casts a faint light on the floral carpet. He pauses in the corridor.
How cold and dark it is up here, he thinks. It's as cold as a morgue. He hears a sound below him. He looks back over his shoulder toward the staircase behind him, fading to black. He switches off the feeble flashlight and immediately can't see a thing. He stands perfectly still and listens carefully, tilting his head. Then he hears David calling his name. It sounds like he's on the second floor, below him. Matthew doesn't answer. David will only want him to go back to the others, but Matthew doesn't feel like part of this little group. He doesn't have to follow their rules, and he has a gun. His heart pounding, Matthew makes his way quietly along the hallway to his right, silently trying all the doorknobs as he goes. His hands are sweaty. All the doors are locked, of course. Coming back down the hall toward the stairs, he peers into the dark sitting room. He stands still for a moment. There is the faintest light coming in from the windows. It's slightly less dark than the corridor, but all he can pick out are the ghostly shapes of the furniture, chairs and sofas, empty and sinister seeming. Then he hears someone coming up the stairs to the third floor. He steps quickly into the sitting room and stands behind the wall as still as a sentry. He tightens his grip on the gun. It's David. He can hear him quietly calling his name. Matthew waits while David searches this side of the staircase, passing by the sitting room, peering in, seeing nothing, and then walks slowly down the hall on the other side of the stairs. After a short while, Matthew decides David must have gone down the servants' staircase. Matthew follows in his footsteps to the other end of the hall. The door to the housekeeping closet is unlocked and opens beneath his hand. He steps inside, turning the weak flashlight on briefly. He turns it off again. Continuing down the hall, he reaches the back staircase and pushes the door open and finds himself on the narrow landing. The door closes behind him, and he stands motionless, listening. Satisfied that David is no longer on the back stairs, he switches the flashlight back on. He ventures slowly down the staircase to the second floor landing, all senses on alert. He turns the flashlight off again and cautiously opens the doorway onto the second floor. He doesn't hear David calling him anymore. He's probably given up and gone back to the lobby. Here, on the second floor, is the room that he and Dana were sharing. He peers down the second floor hall, listening. It's so dark that without the flashlight on, he can't tell if anyone else is here. He walks quietly down the corridor, peeking into the housekeeping closet and the sitting room, then returns to the back staircase and finds himself once again on the first floor. The servant's staircase opens into the dark hallway outside the kitchen. He makes his way silently along the hallway at the back of the hotel and turns, finding himself outside the library. He steps inside. The faintest sliver of moonlight falls now through the French doors. For a moment, he just stares around the room. He spies a large book open on the coffee table. He switches the flashlight on and sees a picture of a 19th century ship locked in the ice. He wonders who was reading it. He sweeps the flashlight around the room and turns it off again. Losing interest, he pauses at the doorway. If he goes right, he knows he will find another sitting room and wind up back in the lobby. He doesn't want that. Instead, he turns to his left and moves back along the rear of the hotel. This time, he recognizes the door to the woodshed. He hesitates, then pushes open the door. Chapter 26. Riley is glad that David is gone. She thinks he's reckless, but she's glad he's gone. Maybe he'll get himself killed. She hears the muffled sound of a door closing somewhere in the hotel, and her nerves jump. "What was that?" she says, frightened. Henry answers nervously, "It's probably just Matthew, or David."
straining to hear what's happening outside their little circle. All she can hear is the wind drumming against the windows. Whether the storm subsides tomorrow or not, they must try to make their way, no matter how slowly or with how much difficulty, out to the main road and try to get help. She thinks of her therapist, Donna, the woman who has been helping her regain a sense of control over her life, or at least trying to. With Donna's help, she's been trying to learn how to manage her negative thoughts. She certainly wouldn't be happy with the way Riley's using alcohol to cope this weekend. But she's trapped in a remote inn with a bunch of strangers, and people are being murdered. She imagines being in Donna's office, telling her all about it. She would say, "You have experienced some terrible things." "Yes, she has." She would say, "Because of this, your mind will sometimes play tricks on you."
"Are you all right?"
Gwen says suddenly. Somehow Gwen is standing right in front of her. She doesn't remember seeing her move from the sofa, but Gwen is squatting down in front of her now, looking intently into her eyes, concern stamped on her face. "I don't know," Riley whispers. Gwen stares back at her, alarmed.
"I don't know," Riley repeats, more urgently. "She's in a strange place.
Hell isn't imaginary, it's real. It's a real place, and it's also a state of mind, and she can feel herself slipping into the pit. She can feel the fear taking over, the paranoia, the need to react. She doesn't want that to happen. God, not here, not now." She grabs Gwen's hand tightly.
"Stay with me," she says.
"Of course," Gwen says, and sits down beside her, the tension between them seemingly forgotten, at least for now.
"I won't leave you," Gwen promises.
Inside the woodshed, a sudden rattling sound coming from the direction of the door to outside startles Matthew. He whirls toward the sound and trips over something, dropping the flashlight before he can turn it on. Completely blind, he senses something in the darkness, something moving. Matthew fumbles from cold and nerves, clutches the gun and raises it. He fires wildly in the dark. David followed Matthew as best he could. He felt his way up and down the second floor corridor, and then made his way up the main staircase to the third floor. He walked down the west side of the hall, quietly calling Matthew's name, and then the east side, finally finding himself outside the servants' staircase. He pushed open the door and listened carefully. It was dead quiet. It was also dark as pitch in the back staircase. He wished fervently that he had a light. He had to find Matthew. Matthew didn't know what he was doing. He was liable to shoot at anyone. He called softly, "Matthew?" There was no answer, but he could be there, in the dark stairwell. Perhaps he'd turned off the flashlight. "It's David." He waited and listened, but there was no answer. He stepped cautiously into the stairwell. He felt around clumsily for the handrail. He searched for the first step with his foot, found it. He started down the stairs, moving slowly, feeling for each step, listening carefully. Where the hell was Matthew? David was frustrated at how difficult it was to know what was going on in the dark. The darkness was so absolute that it was disorienting. It was like floating in space, with nothing to mark where you were. He felt unmoored. He'd felt that way since they'd discovered Dana dead that morning. He found his way to the second floor landing and hesitated. He had a pounding headache. He thought longingly of the bottle of aspirin that he had in his carry-on in his room at the other end of the second floor. David opened the door onto the darkened second floor hall. He made his way to his own room at the other end, ears sharpened for any sound. When he got to his room, he fumbled with his key and opened the door with relief. His room was not quite as dark as the corridor. There was the briefest glint of moonlight coming in through the open drapes of the windows, and then it disappeared. David closed the door behind him. He felt around for his bag and found it on the floor by the nightstand. He searched for the aspirin and then made his way to the sink. He poured himself some water into a glass by feel and took the tablets, relieved to be alone, if only for a few minutes. Spending so much time with all the others under so much strain, he wished it were all over. He was so tired. He wanted to lie down on the bed, burrow under the covers, and never get up. Instead, despite the cold, he spent a couple of minutes splashing icy cold water on his face. Feeling a bit better, he left his room and returned to the servants' staircase, intending to resume his search for Matthew on the first floor hall along the back of the hotel. He could be in the kitchen, the cellar, or in any of the other rooms on the first floor. David is coming down the back stairs when he hears the gunshots. He feels the shock through his entire body, a spurt of fear. He freezes, tries to focus on where the shots came from. He thinks from somewhere on the first floor, from the woodshed, maybe. He stumbles down the rest of the stairs as quickly as he can. His breath is ragged. What if something has happened to Matthew? What if he's too late? Matthew feels the kick in his hand from the pistol and whirls and flees. He's not sure what he saw, doesn't know what he shot at. He doesn't want to stay and find out. He clutches the gun tightly in his hand and bolts out of the woodshed and down the dark hall. He stumbles his way back into the library and stops, breathing heavily, trying to listen over his own noisy gasps. The sound of gunfire finally sends Riley over the edge. She springs up abruptly, flinging Gwen off. Gwen tries to calm her, but Riley is too agitated. She takes off suddenly toward the front door, as if she needs to escape. Riley doesn't know what she's doing, Gwen realizes. She's just reacting, running blindly. Riley! Gwen calls after her, pointlessly. Stop! But Riley pulls open the door and flees into the blustery night, leaving the door open behind her. Gwen hesitates for only a second, casting a desperate look at the others for help, and then grabs her coat off the coat hook and follows Riley outside. She's wearing her sneakers. She has no light, and she must feel her way. It's pitch dark, the moon hidden behind the clouds. She hurries after Riley. Gwen is terrified of going out into the darkness, but she can't let Riley go alone. She wishes David were with her. She can hear Riley somewhere ahead of her in the cold, can hear her scrambling on the ice, falling and picking herself up again, can hear her panicked, heavy breathing. Gwen follows her out over the icy lawn, barely able to stay upright. She slams hard into the broken tree branch that she'd forgotten was there and falls, her bare hands scrabbling at the ground. Gwen realizes Riley is running aimlessly, like a frightened animal. She's running, and that's all. She may not even be aware of where she is. She must reach her and calm her down, persuade her to come back inside where it's safe. She hears voices behind her. She stops briefly and looks back. She can see James and Bradley dimly outlined in the doorway. They are coming to help. The door closes, and all is dark again. She can hear them behind her, quickly catching up. She glances over her shoulder and sees nothing until Bradley and James are almost upon her. Then she sees them, looming toward her in the darkness. She feels intensely grateful that they've come after her. They don't have a light either. They are all swimming in the dark.
"Which way did she go?" Bradley asks.
"I don't know. She was ahead of me, but I can't hear her anymore. I don't know where she went," Gwen says anxiously. The front door of the hotel opens again, and Gwen barely discerns, in the faint light of the open door, Lauren and Ian coming out to join them. Gwen thinks of Henry and Beverly sitting alone in cold animosity back in the lobby. What if something happens to them? But she doesn't really care. They're not her problem. Her first duty is to help Riley. The killer might be out here somewhere, and Riley might run right into his arms. She turns away from the hotel and looks out into the darkness.
"Riley!"
Gwen screams. They all hold still, ears cocked. But all they can hear is the lashing of the trees in the wind.
We should spread out, Bradley says.
He moves off to her right. James moves off to her left. Gwen moves forward over the ice toward the drive, the tree line looming to the right. She's slipping and falling, her ungloved hands freezing from contact with the icy ground. Where did Riley go? She can't see anyone anymore. They're there, but they've all slipped away again into the darkness. The trees and shrubs are menacing shapes in the dark. We have to find her, Gwen thinks, as she slides precariously forward. Chapter 27.
David's heart is pounding so loudly, his breath coming in such short, loud rasps that he can't hear anything over his own fear. He feels his way, touching the wall of the first floor hall with his right hand as he makes his way to the door of the woodshed. When he reaches it, he takes a deep breath and pushes the door open. He curses himself again for not having a light.
Matthew, he says, are you there?
He's met with absolute silence, and he can't see a thing. Riley runs wildly into the cold, icy dark. The terrible fear has taken over, driving her. She runs and slides, falls and picks herself up again, instinctively searching for somewhere to hide, some low place where she can crouch unseen. She needs to take cover. She senses the forest ahead of her and heads for it. Somewhere in the recesses of her mind, she knows to stay hidden, not to make a sound. She reaches the edge of the forest and crawls into some brush. She crouches on the ground, turning herself into a tight ball. She squeezes her eyes shut and rocks back and forth, her hands over her ears, trying to block out everything. Gwen has never been so frightened in her life. There's some comfort in knowing that the others are out here with her, even if she can't see them. It's like she's alone in a dark void. She can't bear to think about David, what the gunshots might mean. Is someone else dead? She wonders if soon there will be no one left at all. She wants to live, but she hopes that if she has to die, she isn't the last one. She doesn't think she could bear it. She is defenseless. She thinks of the small, sharp letter opener that had been lying on the writing desk in their room. She wishes she had it with her now. She keeps going, past the lawn to the drive, every footstep treacherous on the ice. Riley, she calls. Where are you? She takes a few more steps down the drive and stops to listen. She can see nothing, hears nothing ahead of her. How she wishes she had a flashlight. Suddenly she hears a wild howling. Coyotes, she thinks, or wolves. She stops in her tracks, overwhelmed with terror. How has it come to this? She suddenly realizes that she can't hear anyone else. Bradley, she calls urgently. But Bradley doesn't answer. No one answers. Perhaps they can't hear her over the furiously gusting wind. Gwen's heart pounds frantically. She can hardly breathe. She turns around, looks back toward the hotel where she last heard the others. Bradley! Lauren! She cries again, more loudly, her voice infected with panic. But no one answers. She can't think. She is all alone. Gwen stops moving. She doesn't know where anyone else is, whether there's a killer out here. There's a crushing pain in her chest. She thinks she hears a sound like something falling heavily, but she can't tell where it's coming from. With the darkness like a void and the wind swirling around her, everything is distorted. She doesn't trust her senses. For a moment, she does nothing. She doesn't move. For how long, she doesn't know. She has lost all sense of time. Maybe a minute. Maybe 10. She's so frightened, so cold, that she doesn't think she can move. She has to wait for the ache in her ribs to subside. She begins to feel her way back toward the hotel, body low, arms outstretched, looking for Bradley or James, Lauren or Ian, anyone who can make her feel less alone, less terrified. Even as she does so, she's aware that she's abandoning Riley to her fate. Riley,
her friend, who was afraid and vulnerable and irrational. Riley, who needs her. But she doesn't care. Right now, she can't think of anyone but herself. She stops for a moment in the dark